In the desert, oasis where stories ignite. Skip's little bar, a beacon of light. From the Coachella Valley stars to cool everyday Joes, join Patrick and Randy, let the stories flow. At Big Conversations Little Bar, the magic spreads near and far. Backed by the McCallum Theater's grace, celebrate the voices that shape this place.
From the coveted corner booth in a little bar at the center of the Coachella Valley universe, welcome to another Big Conversation with Patrick Evans and Randy Florence, presented by the McCallum Theater. Visit McCallumTheater.org or reach the box office at 760-340-2787. Gentlemen.
Well, Howard, thank you very much. We are back here at Skip Page's Little Bar in the coveted corner booth for another exciting edition of Big Conversations Little Bar. My name is Patrick Evans, and I'm joined by my good friend, my spiritual guru, the Buddha of Palm Desert.
Wow, that felt really personal. You know I've been trying to take some of this off.
Dalai Lama of La Quinta, Randy Florence. How are you, sir?
Good. Good. Thank you for recognizing me again this week.
Absolutely. It's nice to have you here.
You've
been here before, haven't you?
A couple of episodes.
Some of these episodes.
Have all of our episodes been exciting?
Beyond exciting. I think anybody who's listened to the entire library would tell you they're on the edge of their seat for the entire...
If they've listened to the entire library, they're on the edge of something.
Or they should be.
And it's about to crash. I'm glad to be here with you today again.
Most of them. We're not going to name names because that would implicate guests, and we shouldn't do such a thing.
We might get a lot more listeners.
If we started naming guests,
yeah. Let's not do today's guest, though, because he's actually sitting here next to me.
He is. Before we get to our guest, a big shout-out to the McCallum Theater, our presenting sponsor. The McCallum Theater provides all kinds of wonderful entertainment. Their brand-new season is coming up. The catalog is just out. You can order your tickets right now. Go to McCallumTheater.org. To get more information on the upcoming season at the McCallum, we appreciate their presenting sponsorship. And, of course, Skip Page's tireless support of this. He gives us some great real estate in the bar.
Is there a better recording studio in the Valley than this?
Well, KESQ Television is, pretty good.
But you have to say that.
But, unfortunately, I will have to say that the bar selection at KESQ is far more limited.
Oh, really?
Yes, far more limited.
Do they at least have sparkling water?
They do not even have sparkling water, as far as I know. They really need to work on their craft services.
Yeah. I think KMIR does.
KMIR doesn't even have water.
Battery acid.
Reporters stopped by our live shot location to get water.
To get something to drink.
It's tough over there. It's tough. They do have water at their Christmas parties, though, I've heard.
Oh, good.
Their holiday parties. Good. Today's guest is Alan Gitlin, who has been involved in film. I'm sitting in front of one of his scripts, Star Trek Generations. This is what we're going to talk about. No, but actually...
for an hour.
For the entire time.
Page by page.
Let's start.
So tell me,
with
on
the
page
shooting
four.
Alan, thanks for joining us. But we really brought you on because you have gotten very involved with the Palm Springs Women in Film and Television. You serve on the board. But you are heading up the Film Lab, which was created by one of our previous very scintillating guests, Kim Waltrip.
Very scintillating.
We love
Kim.
Yeah. And you, and actually, this is going to be, I feel like, a lot of today's discussion. Randy's appearance in the short film Perfect, which you guys just screened at the Mary Pickford. A very good film. A really nice script, really interesting film. Lots of fun. Randy ran away with the scene that he was in.
I heard that he's up for an award for hottest nostrils.
Exactly.
Hottest nostrils.
Biggest nostrils. It was kind of weird seeing him up there on the screen. You have to deal with that all the time. Have you ever looked at yourself on camera and thought, oh, my God, why did I wear that?
It's usually not about the clothing.
No.
No. And he's also not on a 40-foot screen either.
That's true.
I mean, you know.
Big difference.
Well, maybe someday.
I have a 40-inch television. That's all I can afford.
You've been on the big screen.
I have been. I've seen. No, you know, I think the things, when I look at the screen over the years, I've made some very questionable choices about hair as my hairline was retreating. I made some very questionable decisions about how to pretend like it wasn't going anywhere. But that's a whole different conversation.
Let's talk about Alan Gitlin. He'd probably appreciate that since he joined us today.
Yeah, taking time out of what I know is a busy schedule, Alan. Obviously, I want to delve into your Hollywood career because you brought in some really interesting memorabilia. But let's start with the present and Perfect, because this is your most recent project, and your star is sitting right here. I hear there's a sequel planned around Randy's character.
Perfect, too.
Called Imperfect.
Imperfect.
Yes. Imperfect.
Not even close.
Wow. No, it's a tough crowd. First of all, when you decided to come out to the desert on more of a full-time basis, how did you get involved with Palm Springs Wind and Film and Tom Peacewift?
Well, we bought this house out here probably about 18 years ago, and my wife at the time was still teaching. She was a studio teacher.
And where? Where's that?
At all the studios. So she would have the children on the set. So she was an employee not only of the studio, but also reported to the Department of Education, the local. So it was a big deal.
Right. If kids are on set, they still need to get their school time in.
Not only that, but, you know, also protective. So is this a dangerous stunt? No, we won't. I don't feel comfortable. She could stop the company from doing it. And they could only work certain hours. So if the child was 8 years old, he could only work 6 hours, and three of those had to be school. So they could do it in 15-minute increments. So in between setups, you know, they'd do a relight. The kid would go to school. So that's what Barbara did. So
that's really cool.
Oh, yeah. Let's tell you, I'll date her.
Her Jackie first. Coogan.
Well, clearly you
no,
did.
No, she didn't go that far. Yeah, exactly. We actually met at the Alamo.
Really?
Yes. We were doing a movie. I was living in Dallas at the time, and she was escorting a California kid that went to the Alamo. There's a facade outside of San Antonio that they actually shot the Alamo. So we were doing a TV movie with Brian Keith, James Arness, Raul Julia, David Ogden Stiers. It was a very well done piece. So we met, we became friends, and we were friends for a long time, and then 4 years later we started dating. But Barbara's first foray into it was doing Luke and Laura on General Hospital. Wow. She was Jeannie Francis's teacher. So that's how far back it dates. And we've maintained a friendship through the years. Her husband, Jonathan Frakes, and I worked on this film, Generations. And then we did many episodes together of either Voyager or Deep Space Nine.
Wow.
How did she get into that?
She was a teacher, and her husband at the time was a UPM at ABC and did like Dick Clark stuff. And he says, you know, I just paid a woman to teach the child. You should do it. And next thing she knows, she was doing, you know, General Hospital. So you have to be credentialed.
Jeannie grew, she grew up on that show.
Oh, yeah. She's still on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You on it this week? Yeah. Yeah. I'm on it.
Have you grown up yet?
Yeah, exactly. She's the mayor of that town, whatever the town was. So
I still remember Luke and Laura.
Is it Springfield? Yeah. It's got to be Springfield. I don't
know. No, it's another name.
Yeah,
Springsteen.
No. But you glossed over the fact that Jeannie is married to Jonathan Frakes, who is Commander Riker, now Captain Riker on Star Trek.
Exactly.
I didn't know it, I wouldn't have glossed over it.
You didn't do your research.
No, I did.
This is primarily...
I have all these Chewbacca notes.
This is primarily a Star Trek episode.
Exactly.
Because Alan worked on a lot of that franchise. I mean, Generations was the transition from the original crew, Captain Kirk,
listen to this. He knows more about it than I do.
It was just a job for you. For me, it's a passion. And it introduced the stars of the next generation on the big screen. So
exactly.
It was Patrick Stewart, and so that was the transition. They actually got Kirk and Captain Picard together. And
remember
also
who
Kirk
the
died.
Evil. And who was the evil?
He died.
He dies in this movie.
But doesn't he come back?
No. He's the one guy they haven't brought back, which is, by the way, it's the movie I enjoyed the film, but I hate it because they killed Kirk. Oh. I do not consider it
canon. You okay now?
Who is the evil nemesis in this movie?
was Malcolm McDowell, who played Dr. Sorensen. And I met Malcolm McDowell at the Ojai Inn one day. He was sitting having lunch, and I was too. And I went over and I said, "Can I get a quick pic?" And he said, "Sure." And I said, "Of course, I loved you in Clockwork Orange, but I said, I'm still mad at you for killing Captain Kirk." And he just looked up from his lunch and he goes, "Oh, you're one of those." That's a true story.
Yay. Thank we got our first sound effect.
There you go. No, but it was... it was an amazing experience being on it. And when I worked on, I started on Voyager. And I remember my first week, one of my other assistants, camera assistants, says, "You got to go to the Pasadena Convention Center. They're having a convention this weekend." I said, "I don't have time. We're working 65 hours this week, right?" "So you got to go. You're not going to believe it." Okay. Saturday morning, drive in the parking lot, and I see the people getting out next to me. They're all dressed like the people I worked with the night before. They're all wearing the Starfleet outfit with the little insignia and this and that. I can't believe it. I walk in, and everybody's in costumes. I mean, the place was packed, packed. And they're selling memorabilia. And I remember walking over, and there's a stack of papers, and it's call sheets. A call sheet is what they give you at the end of the day. This is what you're shooting tomorrow. This is what the advance is. Here's where we're doing this and your call time and everything else. I would put those in my back pocket and wash them. They were getting $350 a piece, and they were flying off the table. I was like, oh, my God. So then we go into a session where a director and one of the actors was doing a scene that I happen to work on. I sit down next to two women. "Hi, we're doing this, da-da-da, and we're going to show you a clip." They start the clip, and the two women next to me are saying the lines on a scene that I worked on that I didn't remember what they said. I said, "These people have to get a life." Scary. Scary.
The Star Trek fans are fanatics.
Yes.
And we don't call them costumes, by the way. They are uniforms.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. I don't work in that department.
But there's a little section of my closet that where I have several uniforms hanging.
Your uniform section.
Are you serious?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course. And my wife, she was looking in the closet. She goes, "What are all these costumes doing here?" And I was like, "They're not costumes."
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, no, fans, the Star Trek fans, and so when you work on, and you obviously did a number of episodes, but, you know, working on Generations.
Yeah.
Anything that you could slip out of off the set, the fans just eat that stuff up.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Because, you know, it's total contraband. Like, you can't get it. So we need it, you know. It's like crack to fans.
So let's go back to Texas.
Yes.
Where it all started. Where were you born?
I was actually born in Chicago, but raised in
near
Dallas.
Texas. Near Texas, yeah.
But I was raised in Dallas.
You can fly there.
Exactly. I went to UT. Same class. I started my degree in radio, television, and film, and then finished at North Texas State. And I was doing commercials while I was in college.
But you already knew something before you got to college. You already knew this is what I want to do.
Well, actually, I started as pre-med. I always wanted to do pre-med, and then the Vietnam War started, and I said, this ain't happening. Let's do something I'm going to be having fun at.
Yeah.
So I started with, my background was photography. So then I got into motion picture. So I got to work with some great, great talents. John Alonzo is one who did Chinatown. He was nominated for an Oscar on Chinatown. He did Norma Rae. He did, what else? I forgot.
What was the first time you saw your name on a credit on the screen?
That's a very good question. Probably when I did The Alamo, 13 Days to Glory. It was directed by Burt Kennedy, who was actually John Wayne's writer.
Wow.
And I remember showing up on the set. It was my first real movie. It was a miniseries for NBC. And Bert comes up and introduces himself. And he's wearing the hat that John Wayne did with the picked-up brim with the tassels hanging. He says, "Yeah, John gave this to me on one of our last pictures." Like, wow, okay, I've made it.
This
you know?
Is a real dad. Yeah,
so John had his own writer.
Oh, yeah. Well, at that time, anything went. If you were a big star, you wanted your own writer. You got him. So Bert was into Westerns, and he had a group of guys that always showed up on all these Westerns, and they were, you know, the Wranglers, and they were the guys that did the stunts, and it was amazing to see how this movie came together. you know, shooting in the facade. Interesting point, the gaffer of this movie was the original pre-rig gaffer on the original Alamo. It was like, wow. How
does
that?
What's a gaffer?
A gaffer is in charge of lighting. So you work closely with the director of photography, and the director of photography says, all right, we're going to shoot this part of the scene, and we need to accent this actor and this background light and this shadow, whatever. And the gaffer would then implement it. Let's bring this light over here. We'll bring this little light over here. We'll put a bounce card, whatever. So that was pretty interesting to have the original rigging gaffer of the original Alamo now doing the gaffing on this miniseries.
That's
so
pretty cool.
It was. It is. It's crazy about this business, you know, how it relates and interrelates of people and what they did before. But, you know, early on I was taught that cinematography was a craft. It's like a painter. You know, you paint with light, shadows, contrast, composition. And to watch masters do it, it was remarkable.
Were you a huge movie fan growing up as a kid?
Not really. No. I did shoot, like, home movies. My senior year, I shot a movie for the graduating class, and they put it in a time capsule. So when they opened the time capsule 50 years later, it was not like sand, you know? It all dissolved. Right. Who knew?
They put it on a cassette tape.
Yeah. The cassette tapes didn't exist then, back when I shot this. So that was in 71. Yeah. So, but I got to do a lot of filming when I was in college. You know, did a lot of stuff, commercials. I worked for a radio station there, the McClendons. I don't know if you ever heard that name. Bart McClendon, he had a big radio business back in the day, and I would do his commercials. He had a drive-in, so we would shoot stuff for the station and then show it in the drive-in. So that was pretty cool as a young buck trying to start a career.
When were you first behind the camera?
Behind the camera? Well, there's different parts of the camera department. Okay. So it starts with the director of photography.
Yeah, he kind of walk us through this.
Yeah.
Good suggestion. So in the camera department, the director of photography works very closely with the director. They've talked and prepped, and they've done their homework and figured out how the scenes will be shot. So that's the head of the department. So then we do, the next would be the operators. The operators' eyes to the camera, operating, catching the action. Then with the operator is the first assistant. He is pulling focus. He is loading the cameras, making sure the camera batteries are set, that the aperture set, that the filtration set. Because in the days of film, you had to be very careful of how the exposures were done. So that it was done both with aperture and filters. So if you're shooting a tungsten film outside during the day, you had to put an orange filter in front to correct it. So that was always my responsibility as the head of the department. As a key assistant. Then I had a second assistant who would be responsible for the equipment on the set, where the lenses were, you know, in the middle. You'd get asked for a lens. You had to do a lens change very quickly, or another mag, the slate, the paperwork. And then you had a loader that was usually at the truck who was loading the film, especially if you had two cameras. And most shows had two cameras, an A camera, a B camera. A camera was always the wide. The B camera was catching a close-up. So then they would have it in sync. And then they turn around and do the coverage in the reverse.
So when I'm watching those credits at the end of the movie, and I'm seeing 1,000 people in there, are they all doing something?
Oh, absolutely. But now with digital, you're seeing a lot of the artists that are listed. Right. And then, you know, like a big effects movie, they probably hire 5 different effects companies, one in India, one in China, one in Australia, and they're all allocated a portion that will then ultimately come together in the final cut. So, yes.
And who's responsible for putting that all together, the producer?
Well, the producer will work with a line producer and a unit production manager, and they're responsible for the budget and the allocation of funds or the interface with if it's a studio picture or an independent, depending on how the financing was set up. And they would coordinate, and, you know, the real magic happens is in the editing room. It's one thing to capture good stuff on the set, get it in the can, But when you start going through and you start telling the story in the editing room, it's magic. Just like in Perfect when we started putting together. You know, to be quite honest, I wasn't too thrilled about the script because it was a competition, so people voted on it. So it was kind of like, here's the script, make this a good movie. So,
Randy's in it.
What can I say? But I will tell you, though.
You're getting a spinoff. Your character is
exactly
getting
it's going to be in the sequel.
I'm working on a treatment of that right now.
Can I have smaller nostrils?
There you go. We'll shoot up on it.
We're going to fix
God damn it. I told you guys.
We're going to fix that in post.
Exactly.
We're going to. Industrial Light Magic, their entire nostril.
No, my producing partner. Well, he's the one who did all the effects in the other one, Exit Interview,
yeah.
Where all those
there
those
were some
digital
really cool effects.
Yeah,
that
also
one.
A great short. They screened both of these shorts, and I mean, two very different movies. But that Exit Interview, a lot of pretty heavy special effects.
Not only that, how timely was that message?
Yes.
There, the day after, I think in the New York Times, there was a huge article about a. Embryo that had a birth defect and they corrected it and the baby was born normal. Gene editing. It was like, oh my God,
wow,
art imitating life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it was interesting, you know, and it made the festivals around the world and I think it resonated too impactfully, I think, to people. People didn't want to face it. I had somebody come up after the screening and said, wow, that's a scary thing.
It was
thing.
Just too uncomfortable for them.
Uncomfortable for them. For them. Yeah. It's like, well, you know.
And we try never to have a film be uncomfortable.
Really?
We don't want to bring out any emotions in people.
Now, with Perfect, you were co-director, correct?
No. Laura Lee and Gina.
That's right, Gina was.
Whatever. No, they were doing it. We had another director, and she dropped out. And I convinced Laura Lee that, you know, with your journalistic background, you've been doing this for 25 years, telling stories. It's the same thing. All you have to do is entertain. I have your back. I know how to do the coverage. Get the performances. And she did an outstanding job. I'm so proud of what she was able to pull off with Gina. Absolutely. It was great.
Laura Lee Jackson, who worked at KESQ and does fill-in work with us to this day. And she's in the Coachella Valley Journalism Hall of Fame.
Oh, that's right.
One of the most recent inductees. But she did a great job. And I really enjoyed the movie. It was
such a kick just being on a set. And I know you've been there before on a movie set, but I felt like I had really lived the experience because I was there for 17 hours and worked for like 8 minutes. So I figured that's pretty much what it's like on most movie sets.
A lot of hurry
exactly.
up and wait.
Absolutely.
A lot of hurry up and wait. And, you know, you worked for 8 minutes. They shot 8 minutes of film of you and 40 seconds of it ends up. A lot gets pared down in that editing process you talked about. You touched on it a little bit. But the editing really was where the movie, the story comes together.
Exactly. The pacing and the emotional connection with the audience. You're trying to engage an audience. You know, with a story and a performance. And it's a, you know, collaborative effort in all the departments to come together to tell this story. So.
Well, it sure did on that set.
And so that film now will go on to the
festival
circuit. So, Randy, you're going to be seen on screens across the United States.
My nostrils are going to be everywhere.
Well, like I said, the first big festival will be Holly Shorts in August in Los Angeles at Grauman's. It's a big dog and pony show. When I went last year for Exit Interview, I didn't realize, I thought it was just like short. I mean, they had the Klieg lights out. They had other shows that were being, you know, unveiled at this festival. It was like, oh my God. But I will tell you, it was interesting because Kim and I had this interaction after we saw our competition. The younger thinking projects that were shown there were like, oh my God, people really. My daughter got so upset about the tenor of a couple of the movies. She said, Dad, I'm out of here. I will see you later. I'm taking an Uber home. They were so. One was about a necrophilia, sex in a coffin, teaching. It was like, what? Well,
that was our last podcast, wasn't it?
Ugh.
No, that wasn't. That wasn't the last podcast.
Terrible thing to say about.
So you know, yeah. It's interesting to think what your competition is with the younger set putting it together. But again, this was a competition. Stage 32 supports us, and. We're going to do it again. So we have another competition starting in July where we'll start looking for scripts. And we get about 150 scripts to go through.
And where do they come from? Just are they local?
No. If you ever go on the platform, Stage 32,
Stage 32, right.
They'll say, all right, Palm Springs Women in Film is having a competition. And if your script is picked, we will do a $10,000 production. So that comes under the film lab that I oversee now that Kim originally started. And we will then put it together. Pick the directors, and you know, I will tell you, the people that handled our casting, Steve Ciceron and his group, outstanding.
Yeah.
On this lab, we just did another one that I can't really talk about called The Last Tier, and they got an amazing actress to step up and play this role. It was a very emotional story about a family dealing with cancer. Mm. And I was mesmerized. I couldn't believe the performance that we got.
Well, and Steve's quite an actor himself.
Yes, he is.
He appears in a lot of different stuff.
Every day.
We should corral him to come on the podcast.
Let's do it. Absolutely. He'd love to do it.
So, how did you get involved with when you've had a place out here for a while? How did you learn about women in film and television? What drew you to the organization?
When I first got here, someone introduced me to Levi Vincent. He does film permitting and extras work inside Palm Springs. And we met. We liked each other. He says, wow. He says, you really have some really good credits. I said, thank you. I said, so, I'm on the retirement direction. And, you know, if I can ever do anything, let me know. So then he says, you know, I just got on the board of Palm Springs Women in Film. I think, you know, you should join it. So I checked it out. Okay, another thing to do. So I did. So I was just a member. And then I think Kim saw my credits and she says, oh, I think maybe you should be on the board. Oh, okay. That was a year later. And, you know, one of my mentors was a gentleman named Jack Green. I think I told you that story when we did this, the Ion on the Desert. He was Clint Eastwood's cameraman for many, many years. A wonderful man. Brilliant with lighting. I mean, he was nominated for the movie, for the Academy Award for Impossible? No. What was it? It was a Western that Clint did. I forgot, but anyway.
Unforgiven?
Unforgiven, yes. Thank God. He's a wizard here. So I did pickups with him before I got in the union, and I said, Jack, what a great time. You were wonderful. You were, you know, encouraging, and, you know, we just got everything done, and everything was efficient. Thank you very much. And he says, well, you know, I like to see new talent, because I wasn't in the union. I had just moved to L.A. And I said, oh. He said, when I first got in the business, he said, one of my mentors said that when you get, you know, you achieve success and you've come towards the end of your career, you have to give back to the community. So that's something that I've always done. Even when I was in the union, I used to teach. I went and guest taught at Baylor University. I taught at USC.
Wow.
I taught at a bunch of different schools. I went to Hong Kong to teach. I'm friends with several filmmakers there. So I just felt that it was unique to have the opportunity to give back, to see the younger people coming up in the industry. And that's why, you know, when Laura Lee Shanghai'd me to teach, this is a way of giving back.
Yep.
And I like to see when the spark goes off and see them understand what it's like to really become an artist and use the tools that you have available.
Were you surprised at all about the number of people in this valley that had some sort of a hand in the industry?
Interesting. My last series I did at Warner Brothers was called American Woman. And the producer lived out here, John Riggi, R-I-G-G-I. And he says, yeah, it's great. I run to everybody out here.
Yeah.
Like, oh, wow. Okay. So, yeah, he kind of clued me in. He said, there's a lot of people
out here
that live out here. You know, this is a great way to get away from, you know, I had to go to L.A. last week, in fact, to return the cameras that we did on the last film. And I'm in Burbank going, why am I here? Three light cycles to get past, you know, Olive Street. It was like, wow, I can't wait to get home.
Yeah.
So...
Well, that's what you're doing now, the Palm Springs Movement Film and Television, and Perfect's going to start making the festival circuit. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to acknowledge our presenting sponsor, McCallum Theater. We'll come back. You mentioned you have a very, very long list. In fact, I asked him about this, and he goes, he can't remember all the movies.
I've looked at there's some big, big films
list. Big films. We're going to talk more about your work in Hollywood when we come back after this message from the McCallum Theater.
At the McCallum Theater, we believe in placing arts at the heart of learning. Since 97, our education department has inspired nearly 1 million students and community members through dynamic performances and immersive arts education programs. From the Palm Desert Choreography Festival to our Open Call Talent Project, we provide powerful platforms for emerging artists. Experience how the arts contribute to personal growth and enlightened citizenship, your entertainment, your theater, the McCallum Theater. Learn more at mccallumtheater.org.
And we are back with our guest, Alan Gitlin, who has been involved on the camera side of Hollywood for many, many years. You were telling us a story. You sort of hinted at it, but you were working on the film Titanic.
No, it was called... this was a movie, a docudrama that Cameron was doing called Ghost of the Abyss.
That's right.
But we were at Titanic.
You were at...
Titanic. Right. And I got this close to going down to see it, well, but they replaced me with...
He went down, right?
Oh, he went down every day.
Yeah.
There were two submersibles. We were on the same ship that they used in the filming, the Keldysh. It was a Russian research vessel, and they had two submersibles, and Jim and his brothers designed these bots that came out of a basket in the front of the submersibles, and he actually took them into Titanic. In fact, we had a contest before they went in the water, and I forgot. I think one of the engineers came up with Jake and Elroy. Wasn't that the
Blues Brothers?
Yeah. So the blue one was Jake, and the yellow one was Elroy.
Yeah.
Elwood, yeah. So, you know, and Jim's on the controls. He's like playing video games, and he's taking it down the staircase and down around the ballroom. And he says, I feel like I've been there. Well, he rebuilt that set at 20th Century, you know, so he knew where all the nooks, and he's driving this thing, and he's getting footage that was, like, unbelievable.
And amazing. This happened to be at a pretty historical time.
Oh, absolutely.
You want to talk about that?
It happened on 9/11. You were there.
Well, we were there for 4 weeks.
Yeah.
But, so on 9/11, he had already dove. So getting those in the water is a big thing. I mean, they got to pick them up, and they put them over, and they disconnect it, and they get them aimed in the right direction. And it's 2.5 hours down, just dead drop.
Wow.
2.5 hours down.
2.5 hours just
I can't even imagine.
Straight down through the ocean floor.
Yep. And it was interesting, too. You see all the stuff, the Russian customs. So when you get in, they have a little box that you put your shoes into before you get in it, and they take them back, and they put them in a certain spot on the ship until you come back. Like, ooh, that's a little eerie. But, you know, he had two people to commandeer oversee the submersibles down there. Jim, in his infinite wisdom, had one of them that had a light on it, a big, like a 12K light. So, in other words, if Jim was shooting in one direction, like off the hull, the front hull of Titanic, he would have it side lit with the other submersible because it's pitch black down there. Unbelievable how well he did in getting this footage. And it was amazing. If you ever get a chance to look at it, he originally shot it in 3D.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. It was, you know, when we were doing stuff on the ship where he was, you know, in conversations of, you know, we're going to shoot this tomorrow, we're going to shoot this. I would be pulling what they called convergence. And in early 3D capture, what you're doing is you're taking the two eyes that you're shooting with and you're trying to put where the 3D is in the frame. So in other words, if I was shooting you, I would be looking at it and putting the two eyes together so the 3D would be right on your eyes and you'd be in focus. So this happened not only on the at Titanic, but any of the topside footage that we shot. So it was pretty amazing system.
So you're up on the boat.
Yeah, I never got to go down. No, when he went down, we were waiting. That's why I said I showed you the cups.
Yeah.
So we would do artwork, and I happened to do that one cup that everybody did. These cups. It was a 16-ounce styrofoam cup.
Show them to our camera.
Okay. So when you finished your artwork, you would give it to the pilot who was driving the submersible, and you would put it on a little bag outside, and it would be...
So that was a 16-ounce cup.
16-ounce cup, so three times the size.
So the pressure below the
being
the
outside
surface,
at 13,000 feet.
It would compress that cup to that size.
That's correct. And I was just fooling around the day before, and then this went down at 9/11, and it came back up. So, of course, you know, later in the night after everything happened, we're seeing, you know, satellite footage of the towers going down. They go, oh, here's your cup, by the way. I was like, oh, geez. Wow, okay.
So you were kind of like in the middle of the ocean.
Oh, yeah.
And detached. So how did you get the...
It's a crazy story. First of all, Jim travels with security. You know, he's well known, so he's definitely had a security detail with him. I think the guy was a SEAL. We all became friends. Good guy. We were looking at footage, and we thought someone was pranking us because had really kind of crappy video coming that was like satellite stuff. But then Jim's guys are on the back. Do you remember where the old lady threw the ring off, you know, at the back of the ship?
Yeah, the fantail there at the back.
They're all on these guys, something we should know about. And they're talking to L.A. and this going on. And they, whoa. So the thing was, the executive producer was with us. He would shoot the second unit stuff. And he said, we were deciding, do we call Jim up, you know, 2.5 hours down, you know, it's another 2.5 hours up, and they basically said, no, wait until he comes up. So later that night, he finally came up about 7:30, and Bill Paxton, who was the actor on this, went and met him. He climbed up the gangway to the submersible where the hatch was, where they would enter and exit. And he says to Jim, he says, New York City was attacked. Two buildings went down, and Jim is like, oh, my God, really? Because we were supposed to finish at Titanic and go on and do the Bismarck out of Southampton, and we canceled that part. So it was like Jim says, all right, stop filming. We're going to have to figure this out. And we went into the mess hall, and we started figuring out what was going to happen. So
that's a crazy story.
Oh, it was. Wait, a great story at the end of this. So we ended up going into Halifax to disembark.
Yeah.
They had all this equipment. They had a crane there to pull the special equipment off and stuff like that. So we go into the cemetery where all of the people that were able to gather from the sea and recover and buried them there. The shipping company buried them there. So we're filming.
I've been to that cemetery.
Yeah, it's right overlooking the bay.
Mm-hmm.
So we're filming, and I'm right next to Jim, and we're filming, and he says, I want to get in before this Elder Hostel group comes off of a cruise ship. There were three cruise ships in line in the bay. And so we get in, we shoot, da, 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 da. So, and all right, here comes this first Elder Hostel group, and, you know, they're all 65, 70-year-olds coming, and Jim's filming them. And the tour guide was very flip about this. And he said, this tour guide's back's to us. He said, and here's the grave of Jack whatever. This is the role that Leo DiCaprio played. And he says, you know, Leo should be buried here instead of this guy. And Cameron says, what the F did he just say? And throws the camera at me, and I, like, catch it. And he walks over, and the guy doesn't see him walking over. His back's to us, and he taps him on the shoulder, and he says, "Hi, I'm James Cameron." Now, figure, there's 60 elder hostels standing there, and James Cameron comes over and taps this guy on the shoulder. He says, "Hi, next time I see Leo, I'll tell him what you thought of his performance," and walk back, and he high-fives me when he walks past me, and he says, "That felt like Annie Hall." Remember when he that Marshall McClellan line? It was like, oh, my God. It only happened because I was with Jim.
That's crazy.
That was.
It's a very moving cemetery. I mean, it's remarkable.
And, well, the family, the mother with the two kids there, it's like, woo.
No, it's a,
so well, any tragedy. Let's go back to the films. What's the biggest budget film you've been on?
Well, I remember when I got hired to do Ali with Michael Mann. I remember we were at Panavision prepping the 8 cameras, and our rental agent came out and he said, "This is the biggest budget camera department I've done in a long time." And he's showing us. I said, "Okay, cool." But that was a really uncomfortable movie to work on. Michael Mann is a very interesting guy. You know, it's about him and whatever. I'll leave it at that. But
what made it uncomfortable? Like,
well, he had his own guys, so I was kind of an extra guy that came in. And I remember one time the AD says, "All right, Alan, you're not working on this shot. Get your camera in the ring in that corner, and then we'll come. We're going to hopscotch over, and we'll come and shoot you." So we're waiting 20 minutes, 30 minutes. Here comes Michael and the entourage after they finish this other shot. "What the F is your camera doing in the ring?" Well, we were told to go there. "No, you weren't." And the AD says, "I never told you that." And it was like, I mean, just stuff like that would go on instead of being on top of it. In fact, the studio wanted to fire the AD, and Michael Mann says, "You fire him, I'm going too." And it's like, oh, really? So it was just really uncomfortable. So I left that show, actually. Cameraman was Emmanuel Lubinsky, Chivo. Great cameraman. Really good. In fact, I think he won an Academy Award for the movie he did after that. But, you know, I was pulling focus for Chivo in one of the ring shots, you know, where Ali's sparring. And he's got his phone in his ear. "Get me off this fucking movie." and I hear Michael in the headsets. "Do you got him, Chivo? Do you got him?" It was like, oh, my God, really? So it was not pleasant.
Not a great work environment.
So I left the movie, and I went on to Rush Hour 2.
Okay.
So that had to be a little more fun.
Oh, so I was prepping Rush Hour 2, and everyone said, "I heard you got fired off, Ali." He says, "How long did you stay?" I said, 6 weeks. He said, "Oh, wow, you made a record." So anyway.
Was that the hardest set you ever worked on?
Not a matter hard, but when, you know, you're not in a groove where everything's just falling in place, it's very uncomfortable. You know, I'm there to do a job. I have an expertise just like the next person, and I'm there to make it work, to make sure the director gets what he needs, help the operator, help the director of photography. And when you're kind of like looked down at, it's like, why?
Yeah.
You know, this is not brain surgery.
Well, you know, on that set, you know, these are union shops, for God's sake. Everybody's
a professional. It doesn't make any difference.
But everybody's a professional. Everybody does.
Usually. You know, like on Star Trek, everything played nicely. It was a TV director that did this one.
Yeah.
And Alonzo was like, you know, he needs some help. And I remember one day Sherry Lansing walking onto the set, and John did Chinatown with her. And he said, you know, Sherry, he came up to me. He says, Sherry says, just babysit him. Make sure, you know. And there were times where John had to say, you know, I think if we do this, it'll play better. But I remember one morning, you know, we were already 60 hours into the week. And the director hits the set, and John says to me, he says, watch, he didn't do his homework. He's going to ask me where to shoot, what he wanted to cover, how do you want to shoot it. All right, good morning, everybody. We're in. So, John, how do you want to shoot this shot? We're on the bridge of the Enterprise. John looks at me and says, did I tell you? And John would say, all right, we'll start over here in a wide. We'll come over here. We'll do Steadicam. We'll take Shatner around to the back, da-da-da, you know.
David Carson was the director.
Yes, exactly.
And because so Generations was when Star Trek: The Next Generation, that crew got their big screen
exactly, chance.
And the series had come to an end, and It was a swan song for Shatner and that crew, and not everybody came back. It was only Shatner and the guy who played Scotty, the guy who played Chekhov.
Chekhov and Scotty were in it, yeah.
Because they couldn't get either Nimoy or DeForest Kelly to reprise, because they were tiny little roles.
Really?
Yeah, right.
And they just wouldn't play them?
No, because the main crew had a big send-off in Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, and it was a really great farewell to that crew. Then they had this... I didn't love this movie for a lot of reasons. It, like, they really shoehorned Kirk into it, and then they kill him, you know.
Yeah.
Sorry if you haven't seen it. It came out in 1994, Randy. It's not a spoiler point.
It was next in the queue.
Yeah. Really not a spoiler alert at this point. But, yeah, and it was done through Paramount's television division.
Wow, look at you with the details.
This every time we start
and it's stuff that I know about that show. I don't even register to even say it.
Yeah. Rick Berman, who executive produced the TV series, was in charge.
He was very pivotal. And Peter, what was Peter's name? But he was also riding shotgun with Rick. So they were all a team.
Do you have a sense for what you think your best work was?
My best work. I did a movie with Michael Caine, Bob Hoskins, and called Ghost of the Abyss. God, I'm wiped. World War II When Lions Roar. And it was the first time high def was used to record and film a story that aired on NBC as a miniseries. And they were not high def. They were still standard def, which meant it was a lower resolution that doesn't exist anymore. So it was it had to be shot in a way because when it was, it had to do with the Malta Conference. And it was Churchill, it was Stalin, and it was
FDR.
And they would all play in their own environment. So, you know, like Stalin would talk to Churchill, why are they doing this, da-da-da. So what we would do is we would film one of them, put the TV up for eyeline, and then they would perform to the TV. And then if he had
the footage you shot.
The footage we shot, we used it as eyeline so FDR could see where to talk. And it cut together beautifully. If you ever get a chance to watch it, it was amazing. And I'll never forget, we did it before we did Star Trek Generations. And I was with... Alonzo, and we were in the bay off Santa Monica shooting the holodeck scene, you know, on the ship. You remember that at the beginning?
Yes, of course, yeah.
And I hear, get Len, get over here. What? Get over here. And so I run to the back of the ship. I got my camera. We're doing handheld stuff of the crew and everybody. He says, they're going to try to put the film look on this. I can't believe it. We shot it a certain way. I thought. I said, John, I'm not... He says, but I'm mad. I said, okay, I get that.
Thank you for
telling
me. So
then on top of it, the movie gets nominated for Emmys. John gets nominated. The hair and makeup for the actors was phenomenal. The costuming, the sets were amazing. In fact, we had Roosevelt's grandchildren come in. They said, wow, this is like we're back in his White House. So anyways, the Emmys happen. John loses, but the lighting director that CBS made us use because we were on their lot won. Because how in the hell? I told him where to put the lights. How does he win? Oh, my God. I had to hear about that for a month after that. You know, it was beautifully shot, though.
You liked how that was. What are some of other your favorite projects that you worked on?
What else? Mission Impossible. I got to do second units on those. It was an interesting story. We were shooting what they call a double-up unit. So we were at the Rykoff building downtown off of Alameda. I don't know if you guys remember. It was a big warehouse for grocery distribution. It was empty. So we're shooting this big shoot 'em up scene. So Tom would be at first unit. They'd shoot him, get done. All right, we're relighting. Then he'd come to our unit, and we would shoot this other scene and, you know, finish that out. All right, Tom, we're ready for you at first unit. And we'd go back and forth. We did this for a week. So that Saturday night, I went out to dinner with some friends of mine. What are you working on? Oh, I'm working on Mission Impossible. Oh, really? Did Tom have the tent? What?
What?
I said, how did you know about that? She says, I read People magazine. And he had a tent on the set that in between shots he would go to that he had his spiritual advisors with. And it was like, you know, we were told, guys, low key, no one knows about this. And to be confronted with magazine. This, it's like, how did you know? I read People magazine.
Everybody knew, apparently. Oh, that's crazy.
Oh, that's scary stuff. But, you know, interestingly enough, chill dude on set, loves the tech. Hey, guys. Alan, what am I shooting here? What are we getting? We're getting you here. Okay, good. All right. Do the shot. You'd go back over to the other side. And, you know, once they're in that environment, you know, they nurture those relationships, the real pros. Even Michael Caine. Michael Caine was like that, too. You know, he wanted to know, what are we doing? How are we? He would always come to me because I was always on the camera, you know? So, Joe Sargent was an amazing director. He got so many Emmys for so many different TV movies and films. But, you know, a lot of times the actors know that we have a rapport because we're working. You know, you need to help me. If we're on a tight lens, don't do this. You know, just kind of so I can keep you in focus. So, you know, those were the ones, those were great experiences. You know, John Lithgow would say, you know, hey, what do you got on me? I do this. And you know, it was a cowboy. So, you know, it gives them a comfortable feeling of knowing what they're doing. Because
what's a cowboy?
A cowboy is a waist up.
What? Okay.
Two T's.
All right. Middle chest.
Yes.
And then
close up.
Close up. All right.
So those are the little hand signals, you know.
Randy, you want a lot of cowboy shots. That's what.
Exactly.
That's what you want.
People have asked me not to be. My face not to be in the scene.
Exactly. I actually did a small movie with Faye Dunaway. I did as a favor. John Alonzo asked me to do it for her. So she was directing. It was a Tennessee Williams story. I said, okay, I got a week off. I'll help her. So we're working. So I was the A-camera operator on it. And long, long hours because, you know, under budget, underfunded, and, you know, they're trying to get it all done. So I'll never forget, it's 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm bringing this beautiful ingenue down the steps, you know, very careful, bringing him down. And I'm on what they call wheels. You know, it's not point and shoot. It was, you know, you finesse it in so you don't see the moves. So we're on the third take, roll camera. She starts to come down and hears, I turn around, Faye swallowed a tooth, a cap off of her front tooth. Big gaping hole.
Oh my God.
4 o'clock in the morning. It was like, oh my God. So, you know, she says, okay, I think that's a wrap for tonight after 16 hours. So next day she came in, she had it fixed. But, you know, those are those little things, you know.
Who are a couple of your favorite directors to work with and why?
Well, Joe Sargent was amazing. He was really intricate in really evoking performances, you know. That was a great one. Who else? Jonathan Frakes.
He's a great director.
Not only that, he's an actor who knows how to get a performance, you know. And though that's key, because I think some directors come up through the ranks and they don't really know the interface that an actor has to go through, thinking of what he's having to deal with in front of all these people trying to give a performance. So I remember one night we were on Deep Space Nine. We had to be in our 14th hour, and LeVar Burton was directing. So the Steadicam operator, James, somehow, I don't know why, he says, LeVar comes out, did we get this coverage and was it all good? And he says, Jordy, I think we got it right. He says, okay, good. And everyone went, Jordy? He responded to his character name.
Wow.
And he says, it must be late because I responded. He says, next time you call me Kunta Kinte, he says, I'm not answering. So, you know.
Yeah, Frakes has become quite a prolific director.
Oh, he's very good. In fact, we've got a project we're trying to put together right now. So.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
The other guy that I know you worked with because he was on Voyager, Duncan McNeil. Tom Paris, the guy who played Tom Paris.
Oh,
he's doing a lot of directing as well.
Really?
Yeah.
Nope. Our paths didn't cross once I left Star Trek. Oh, so, okay. You know, you never know.
Anybody you really wanted to work with, you just didn't get the chance? Or have you worked with everybody
you were on that list, and now he's worked with you.
Oh, yeah, there you go. It topped it off here.
You can retire now.
Well, someone who I've been very close friends with for many years is Linda Gray, and she's a wonderful actress. And I can't say much, but I just finished doing a movie with her, and she was phenomenal. Gave a riveting performance. Still has it. Still has the chops. And it's just wonderful to see somebody like that. And we've known each other for a long, long time, and it's wonderful to work with someone like that. So
another one we need to get on the show.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell Patrick she has indicated
she would love to do it when she has time.
So maybe when we roll this movie out, that would be the
perfect time to get her on, both on Eye in the Desert and on our podcast. That would be tremendous.
And I'll keep you posted on that.
Well, yeah. It's always special for me to come bring a guest in who has a long history with Star Trek. This is fun for me, but you have such a diverse history. But I love what you're doing with P-Swift. I think that's such an important idea. Kim came up with a great idea because when she stepped in, she's like, we should be making movies and making our members.
Sure, exactly.
You know, learning how to do every aspect of it. And I think it's a really phenomenal project, and it's terrific that you're involved, and thank you for taking some time to do this.
Absolutely.
It was my first set, and it was interesting to me how much of a presence you had on the set.
Well, keep in mind, these are people that have never really worked in Hollywood or worked on a real set. And the object of the lab is to teach people about making motion pictures.
Yeah.
In fact, I teach a class twice a year to the P-Swift or the public called Setiquette. What does an assistant director do? What does a gaffer do? What does a best boy do? There's a best boy in both the electric and the grip department. They handle equipment, the staffing, the invoices, the time cards. So there's a lot of intricacies, you know, and I bring in a call sheet from a show that I did previously, and I go down the list. This is the actor's information. Here's the scene they're going to be shooting. Here's the props we need. So it's a real introduction as to what actually goes on a real set.
It's awesome for you to get back.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
For somebody who is their first time, thank you.
Especially someone with the depth and breadth of your experience to impart that to these folks.
Oh, yeah.
And they get to see what it really was like to work on a set in a Hollywood environment, and that's what you bring to the table. And you brought it to our podcast today, and we are greatly appreciative. Alan Gitlin, you can look up his IMDb, and you'll be amazed at all of the movies that he's worked on over the years. Thank you so much for joining us for this edition of Big Conversations, Little Bar. Our thanks to Skip Page and his team at Little Bar. Our thanks, of course, to the McCallum Theater, our presenting sponsor. Please be sure to get the catalog and start ordering your tickets for the upcoming season. You'll want to make sure that you have those tickets sooner rather than later. Randy, you do such great research. You are the heart and soul of our research department.
Don't make me cry.
Actually, you are the research department.
You did
department.
An amazing job. Very good questions.
Oh, good.
He really does. And, of course, our producer, John McMillan. Who's that
McCulkin.
Guy? McCulkin. No, let's just not go down that road. That's a painful, painful memory, Randy. You wound me. John McMillan, thank you very much. And we thank you, our audience. Remember to subscribe.
I think that Randy should... His next movie should be as Nostradamus.
Nostradamus.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can bring back my old porn name, Rock Hard. That's my new name.
Ouch. Really? Move right along.
My understanding was you really couldn't bring that name back.
You've been talking to my wife.
We can edit this whole portion out. Good gracious. Hey, thank you guys. All of you. And again, Alan, thank you so much for taking us
on. My pleasure.
Thank you all. Remember to subscribe so you never miss another episode of Big Conversations, Little Bar. I'm Patrick Evans.
Meet your neighbors, fascinating and grand. Each conversation, a wave on the sand. Raise your glass and join the ride, where stories and dreams fully collide. At Big Conversations, Little Bar, brought to you by McCallum, our guiding stars for movies.
Patrick and Randy, tales retold.